as I said, fire is the tool that I see as being the most useful, you know. Right. So, and I don't know, like, as a landowner, I live up here in Forest Ranch, and I live in a mixed conifer forest, black oaks, ponderosa pine, sugar pine, etc. And my ultimate goal is not to ever have to run a chainsaw again. I just want to, you know, when I get older, to just set fire and let that do the work that needs to be done, you know.
So it's kind of like Dulce being a little kid again.
It's kind of like Dulce was talking about it. Yeah. It's kind of funny. I was down this week at a conference in San Francisco, and I stayed at my parents' house. I grew up in the peninsula, and my parents were, you know, talking about how some of their friends were asking if I ever played with fire when I was a kid, and I never did, actually. I always directed people how to play with fire. So I remember, and I told my parents, I said, yeah, the boys down the street, they were always troublemakers, like they were playing with matches, and I'd tell them what to light on fire, but I would never do it myself, you know. Yeah. So I wanted to stop here because this is another place that I mean, everything around us has been burned at one point or another, and we use fire all the time out here, but this particular knoll that we're at is something I think is a really good indicator of what maybe the potential could be in our efforts to bring fire back into at least grassland oak woodland ecosystems. And that is that, you know, this, just like everything else I talked about, was covered in star thistle, and while there's still star thistle out here, it's in pretty low densities. This past year in September, I walked out onto this knoll, and I was thinking back to the first time we put fire on it, and it was almost entirely star thistle. And, you know, it was Paul Maslin and myself burning this entire thing off, you know. And again, we're using the landscape as our way of controlling it. So we've got a drainage down here. We've got a series of springs that run along this hill slope here, which you can't really tell right now, and then that oak litter. And the time of year when we're burning this, it's not going to creep in more than 10 feet onto that slope over there. And we've got the drainage down here that's going to contain it. So we did a fire that really, we were trying to get the intensity to get the star thistle moved out. So we started it down on that slope and kind of brought it up over the top. And I think we're into our third or fourth entry within the last 10 years on this knoll. But what really stood out to me in September, standing out here, and it's kind of hard to appreciate now because we're starting to see this green coming back in, is that 50% of the vegetation that was out on this knoll in September was native species. So 50% of the cover was native species. And it wasn't a huge amount of diversity. In the springtime, there were lots of geophytes, so the bulbs, the Indian potatoes, those kind of plants were covering this hillside. But what stands out and is still kind of dominant are the things like the doveweed, you know, which is a native plant. Mm-hmm. And it's everywhere, right? We've got a lot of the bunch grasses, the blue wild rye. They've all done really well out here. And this is all stuff that you know, we had tried plugging this after the first time we burned it, and the plugs failed. And then we just said, okay, let's just keep applying fire, and let's scatter a few seeds, and then let's stop sowing seeds, and let's just keep burning it, and let's see what happens. And so, again, you know, this we've put fire in it multiple times, and you know, we're starting to see the change that's happening just by using that one tool, which I think is really powerful. And it doesn't take a lot of, obviously it takes some skill to do it, but it's not an incredible amount of skill, and it's not a huge amount of resources to be able to do it. Last year, I got an email from East Bay Regional Parks. They had heard about our burn programs up here, and I actually, you know, work with them quite a bit, but randomly got this email from somebody who was in their, you know, stewardship program. And they said, hey, you know, we're really interested in learning how we can use fire to shift, you know, from the annual grasses to native perennial grasses, and you know, you guys have really good success with it. You know, what's your timing on that, and then how much does it cost? I was thinking, how much does it cost? Like, we don't calculate that sort of thing. So I had to think about it. It's like, okay, typical burn, what do we do effort wise and just off the top of my head, thinking, okay, well, if we go out there with a trimmer in some of these areas, like on the other side of the canyon, we've done some, you know, areas that are 40 to 80 acres, blue oak woodlands, burn those off. Like we will sometimes break up those areas into units. And so if we're using a trimmer, you know, weed eater, create a little break that's maybe 4 or 5 feet wide. And then we're standing out there with backpack sprayers, and how long are we standing out there? How much time was invested in it? I think off the top of my head, I estimated it was like $80 per acre to burn, you know, 40 to 80 acres, which isn't bad in comparison to some of the other projects, like the VMP project that some of the other folks are out walking on. Of course, this is part of the VMP project now too, but you know, that's over $500,000 is put into 420 acres and not very much fire has been put on it yet. And I think, well, our way of burning, the way we've been doing it, has been a lot more cost effective, you know, and that's not to belittle the VMP program and that way of burning, but you know, as landowners and as land managers, I think we have a really good ability to do it without having to go too excessive with it, right? And but you got to be smart about it.
Sorry, there's no hose lines here.
There isn't. We generally are not running hose lines. Very simple equipment, right? Backpack sprayer, McLeod. In terms of even ignitions, a lot of times it's just grab a lighter. You know, if you need to build the intensity on a fire like this, on this hill slope, if it was too wet and, you know, we wanted to try to increase the intensity, we might grab a drip torch, and that drip torch maybe has a hotter fuel mixture in it. You know, a typical drip torch is like, 25%, you know, gas to diesel. I'll sometimes run 50% just to get it hotter to build the intensity, particularly in the star thistle, right? But it's knowing that in how to move the fire in that landscape, you know, that's really critical, and not having to have all those tools there.
When you said packed sprayers, those are water sprayers.
So collapsible water tanks, typical, you know, yeah, and they're very useful. You know, and a lot of times people ask me on the cultural side of it, you know, well, hey, those tools aren't tools that, you know, indigenous people had. Well, people use their bare feet in the past to do that, or they use branches, you know, from trees to smother the fire. So while the tools may be different, the approach is still the same. And that's really it, you know, is knowing how and what you want to achieve in that landscape, right?
So you're using traditional approaches with some modern technology.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes, like Kyle even mentioned it, you know, when he came up talking about, you know, grabbing grass, and, you know, Kyle learned to burn with me. And when we first came out to burn, you know, I wanted him to have that experience of what his ancestors would have done too. So take the grass, you know, and the dry grass, and light the dry grass, and, you know, and you create a bundle that you're going on and igniting with. You don't need to have a drip torch. One of the things I think a lot of people make a mistake with drip torch is that you can put a lot of fire on the ground very quickly with the drip torch and have a very big fire that is easily out of your control. Whereas if you're starting small and just putting a small fire on the ground here and there, you have the ability to see what it's doing with the wind and what its behavior is, and then move on from there. And as you build your confidence with fire, then you have the ability to take on more, right? That confidence is really what I think what's important in building that skill. You know, for me, you know, I think back, like, my earlier experience with fire was around pile burns, you know, and how effective are any of us with pile burning, you know, and the time of year we do it and so forth. The Caples fire this last fall, right? You know, they called it an escape prescribed burn, but it was pile burns that got out of control. And I think, well, you know, like, there's something to be said about knowing the fuels, right? You've now created these piles with a bunch of dead brush and set it on fire at a time of year when everything else is tinder dry in the landscape around it. Like, there's a high risk that's associated with it versus knowing, you know, when you can safely put it on the ground in a place like this at the right time of year and have a very low risk of it moving anywhere.
What's your time of year? Did you have a regular time of year you're burning this?
This is typically done usually October, November time frame. We've done it as late as like around this time of the year, December.
And what's your return, like what's your frequency? So you go on four times?
Thanks for bringing that up. So actually I was reminded to tell people about this is, you know, usually once you start to establish a native species back in, you're not able to carry fire every year into that system. It's about every 2 years when the fuel load finally gets to a point where you can carry fire again. Whereas if you're working, like Gus talked about the Swedes fire, right? In the tail end of his presentation. So Swedes fire, you know, that's had three fires on it since 2013, I believe. And it's type converting, right? And some of these fires, they could happen almost every year because all it's doing is replacing annual grass with annual grass, right? What we're trying to do is break that cycle by putting perennial native grasses back in and perennial herbs and forbs and, you know, other native species in there where their distribution is not so dense that it's going to allow for fire to spread through it. So even though this is always potential for fire to spread through it on a wind event, under normal conditions, it's not going to carry through here. And we'd be hard. But then we also then shift the opportunity for when that fire could take place, right? So my ultimate goal is, like, we're burning now with a focus on the fall burn, but I know that once I get these perennials established, and, you know, if you go back in early Spanish records, they talk about the green hills of California. That's our perennial grasses. They were green because after the flowers came up, you know, the seed stalk come up, seed set, the grass comb starts to brown out, they were set on fire to help to sow the seeds and to allow for those grasses to green up again based off the carbohydrate reserves. So those carbohydrate reserves are then creating a green grass that's then going to be resistant to fire later in the season.
Talk about late spring.
Yeah, it'd be late spring, early summer, right? And so we then shift the time frame for when these different fires would take place, right? And then you're providing something that the deer can benefit from and the grasshoppers are benefiting from. And some of those fires that I pointed out in the oak woodlands that were taking place in the middle of summer was for grasshopper harvesting, right? So these are not big fires, these are small fires, but, you know, you set an acre to capture grasshoppers, and grasshoppers are a good source of protein, and, you know, it's like, yeah. That's it.
True story, dude.
10 years from now.
Yeah, you never know.
We have to farm them, though.
Yeah. Well, it's out here. This is your wild food, right? So, yeah, those are really important things, I think, for people to be aware of, you know, and the seasonal timing of when we approach, you know, burning in an oak woodland or any of these vegetation community types. They each have kind of an optimal time frame when you're going to minimize your damage to those plants. And enhance their productivity. And that's something that's really critical to be aware of, regardless of where you're at within the landscape, you know. And I think about it this way, is that every veg community in California has some relationship to fire. Either they're fire sensitive or they're promoted by fire. But if we're not thinking of just being afraid of it all the time, when can we safely put that fire into that spot? There's an opportunity somewhere in some elevational gradient on some slope and a different aspect to be able to run fire, you know. So if I look across that ridge there and I'm seeing that kind of southeastern facing slope there, you know, what time of year do I want to run fire in that chaparral? Well, when's its fuel moisture going to be highest, and when is my risk going to be lowest for it to be able to move to the north facing side? And now that I've got that burned off, maybe if I burned it earlier in the season, then I've got the north facing chunk that I can take off later in the season when it's ready, you know. And I see this on a lot of burns. Sometimes we try to force fire into places where it doesn't make sense. You know, we've got places out here like that Unit 5 that some of the folks are walking in, coming down from the gate. That's a north-facing slope. We have a really hard time. We've had one or two fires in parts of it, right? But we've never been able to run it through the entire thing.
Because it just won't burn.
Yeah, the window of opportunity is very narrow. And, you know, so we're looking at the ground, we're seeing what's coming up, and then, okay, are we able to light or not, you know? And if not, you lose the window of opportunity. You know, we lose it more often than not. This little hill slope here, you notice that we have a little population of gray pines here. Question is, a lot of people think about gray pines not being useful, you know, and conducive to fire, or overly conducive to fire, right? But the point is that under the right conditions and the right type of burn, you can actually do an underburn under gray pines. Gray pines do accumulate a lot of detritus, you know, organic material around the base, because the cones and the squirrels come and they eat and they build up. But if you look through here, you see that several years ago we ran fire. Haven't run fire in a while, and now I see the starch comes up and I want to burn it again. But if you look at the base of these trees, you see a little bit of the fire scar on them, right? That fire scar is on the upslope side where the fuel load was a little bit higher. But we've limbed up these trees, and they've all survived low to moderate intensity fire. And I've seen trees in the Buzztail community here in Forest Ranch that were killed by the campfire. Once those trees were felled, I saw fire scars in them from the 2008 lightning complex. Mm. So some of these trees actually do have the ability to survive a fire. And so I think that there's a lot of things that we don't know about, or at least, you know, it's not published in the literature about certain species like grapevine. They tend to be underappreciated because they're not commercially valuable, yet they happen to be one of the species that is culturally important, right? Mm-hmm. So pine nuts and even the smaller lateral branches on the trees are used to make baskets with. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's different reasons and a different cultural value for that, right? So it's not about the money making, it's about, you know, what's it providing for the system.